Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
Right off the bat, I should mention that a lot of this episode comes from a book called The Jewish Alchemist by Raphael Patai. That was my main source for a lot of these guys to even go off and consider them as like, oh yeah, let me see what else I can find on Abraham or Moses or whatever. And some of these we've mentioned before, some of these characters. But this episode will add another major piece to the puzzle of understanding the history of alchemy and many, many alchemical references. Because today it's easy to forget that at one point the Bible was taken as gospel,
so to speak.
Did you?
I got it.
No, I mean, but seriously, science, like scientific knowledge, wasn't necessarily. Now I can't. Okay, but like, science.
Hold on, you're so lame.
But science, in quotes, like scientific knowledge, wasn't necessarily thought to be discovered and invented, but rather revealed divinely. Like we've said that many, many times on the show. Knowledge came from God. I mean, alchemists definitely, well, at least a big branch of alchemists believed this. So when we really try to put ourselves in the shoes of alchemists throughout history, from the 4th century to the 18th century, it's too easy to take our separation of church and state or the separation of science from religion for granted, because, I mean, remember until about 1872 or so, when people started to definitively date Sumerian cuneiform, people thought that the Bible was the oldest book in history. People thought that the Bible was the oldest written thing that we have. So, I mean, that's just to kind of paint you a picture of how important the Bible was as a source. Even if they fought the church, everything was seen in relation to it, you know, even if they hated it, let's say. But in this episode, we'll try to give you a much better idea of where the alchemists from the early modern period, that's, you know, 15, 1600s, where they thought from their own historic perspective, that is the history of alchemy, where they thought that came from, going all the way back to and in their eyes mentioned in the Bible.
And in fact, this episode can sort of work out as a tool to understand some of the previous and future episodes just a little bit better. A lot of our references in alchemy will get cleared up here because of this show and our look at the biblical connection to alchemy. We want to really take a close look at the Jewish alchemists and their influence on the field as a whole over the centuries that were to come from this. So, which is actually kind of a hard thing to do, you know, when you're having something. What's something Travis, you and I have been trying to work at, which is, you know, the Jewish alchemists, the Middle Eastern alchemists, they're very, very important. But sometimes mm-hmm. there's just not that information that we can hold on to or easily reference.
It's some of the very earliest things we have, period. Like Zosimos of Panopolis either was Jewish or definitely was very familiar with the religion. And then, you know, he writes of Miriam the Jewess, who is, well, that's why she's called that. And it goes forward from there, but sources are scant. I mean, we just don't have a lot of written records. Now, I mentioned before that Muslims and Christians tried to make alchemy work within their own worldviews. And some of the easiest way to do that is make them seem like this Hellenistic philosophy, okay, like this ancient Greek philosophy, which includes like Plato and Socrates and everything, to kind of make that seem like it was actually started by Jews. Because that way you can say, oh, this was, you know, these people either got the knowledge from the Bible or, you know, from the same God that we got the Bible from, or, you know, it was even divinely given to them. So there's nothing wrong with being a Muslim and an alchemist. And there's nothing wrong with being a Christian and an alchemist. If you can date it back to Judaism. So there was a, both in the Arab world, and then the Christians kind of took it from that. There was a big drive to do this, always, to make it jive with Islam and then later Christianity. The prophets and the kings of the Old Testament, they knew the secret art themselves, so they were, you know, divinely given alchemy. But yeah, so we just see these Old Testament figures being recast as alchemists, as people that knew the secret of how to make the Philosopher's Stone, how to live forever, live longer. Remember, people in the Old Testament had really long lives, like Methuselah lived to, I don't know, 1,000 years or something. So that was also explained in terms of alchemy.
And because of that, the following got drafted to be post-mortem alchemists, if you will. Mm-hmm. Number one, just thinking off the top of my head here, Adam, Tubal-Cain, a descendant of Cain, who was very good at metalworking. That was one of the things that was mentioned in the Bible there. Mm-hmm. Moses, all right, you know, and then Solomon. You know, of course, yeah. We talked about King Solomon's mind and all this other.
It doesn't take a stretch of the imagination, does it, to think like, oh, he might have, you know, he was so wealthy, maybe God and you know, God gave him wisdom, right? So what wisdom did he give him? Because his wisdom then led to riches. It's almost impossible to not, if you're an alchemist looking at this, it's almost impossible not to see it.
Exactly, and I think if you go back to the Old Testament and you're looking at the connection that the chosen people had, the Jewish mm-hmm. nation considered to be the chosen people, there was always somebody there that was able to have a conversation with God. Mm-hmm. Either it was coming from God just to you, and then there might be opportunities for you to have that conversation and go back to God in that sense. And that really is a foundational or a keystone to what we see in alchemy through the ages, that there's supposed to be that kind of conversation, so to speak. And mm-hmm. the Jewish population, this was very, very important for that to be a recipient of God's word. So starting in the Middle Ages, you know, this basically was all going through as alchemy started to really get its foothold during in Europe, when it hit Europe. The transition started for Christian alchemists to seek out the Jewish sage, you know, because they were recipients of these, you know, great words of God. And so you need to go to, you know, you're going to take your car to a mechanic. You're not going to take it to a librarian, right? So, you know, if you have a problem with the car. So you're going to go right to the source. And we see this through the Kabbalah in general.
Mm-hmm. It was, this really did kind of become a tradition. We see this with, there's so many examples. I don't want to spoil, but just like Nicholas Flamel, who, you know, had this book in Hebrew and you know, had to get it translated, had to find a Jewish scholar to translate it. This really became entrenched. So you if you were to study alchemy, you would go south or east and seek a Jewish scholar, preferably an alchemist directly. But, you know, Kabbalists, you know, those just any kind of occultists were obviously very popular. And this tradition, luckily, gives us some insight into Jewish thought of the period. It's kind of neat because people sought this out. So especially Jewish alchemical thought, we've seen this. We've pointed out that there's Hebrew letters now and then. There's names for the divine, angels and demons. There's a lot of Hebrew influence, including the characters. And we start to see like these Latin Christians writing down these Hebrew characters, and it's obvious they don't quite know how to pronounce them, or you know, they're just copying what they see. But yeah, that this is what grew out of that. Yeah, now we've already given at least a dozen examples of this in our podcasts of Christian alchemists learning Hebrew, Ramon Llull being one of my favorite. But let's back up here and kind of go back to the beginning. We've done a whole episode on Zosimos of Panopolis. But yeah, let's bring him up in this context now.
All right, so Zosimos of Panopolis really noted the fact that alchemical expertise came from the Jewish population, right? From mm-hmm. from the sages, the Jewish sages. Again, this is also to be known as the oldest alchemical text in existence today. And so Travis, what was that oldest text that we were speaking about again, right?
Yeah, it's the Leyden Papyrus, I guess, because it's in Holland, or just in the Netherlands somewhere. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And he also spoke very highly of Miriam the Jewess, and he also said the Jews had a higher understanding than the Egyptians. Now, if that's not a mic drop, I don't know what else is, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the Egyptians talk about, you know, this whole deal because, you know, the Jews were considered to be slave population to the mighty Egyptians. And, to, you know, if I can take a saying from from an American slave after the American Civil War. Looks like the bottom rail's now on top, right? So, you know, that's really interesting sort of talk that Zosimus Panopoulos would say, because that really is really kind of putting in a pecking order about where the Jewish sages really rank, right? So actually, it's fun to kind of to really break down what Zosimus says here, because he wrote that the Jews were the only ones to get the sacred knowledge of alchemy from the Egyptians. If you were kind of to relate that to maybe in the Christian sort of sphere of things, remember the Gnostics? They were the ones that were only allowed to understand God's word. You know,
yeah, and this is that this is that same time period. Exactly.
Same thing. Yep. There had to be basically centers of knowledge that the rest of the average folks just, you know, could not really be part of. And so if you were an alchemist of any salt, you went after these sages for sure. So, you know, he's saying the Egyptians, you know, had it first, right? So that puts them that they had to get that the Jews had to get that knowledge from somebody. It was the Egyptians. But he's also saying that the Jews had surpassed the Egyptians in their knowledge set, and we're now the best people on earth to really deal with the science of alchemy, right? So let's just to see if we can get this straight. Because Zosimus was all of the following: Hellenic Egyptian in the Ptolemaic Egypt, possibly a Jew, certainly a Gnostic, which is one of the, which is own sort of can of worms you can open up here, because that doesn't really mean of one single belief set. And also he was a Hermeticist, a big one.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, I always kind of wondered why or how he saw Jews being the best at alchemy living with Hermes Trismegistus, because he really was, I mean, he really was a Hermeticist. Like he wrote a lot about that too. And this character has more Greek and Egyptian roots, not Jewish ones. But Zosimus does make this somewhat clear. And this is, again, important in understanding all future alchemy from him going forward. From the Arabs and Persians to medieval monks to alchemists in the Renaissance and into the early modern period, that the Hermetic and Jewish relationship got rewritten, distilled, and kind of reconjoined back into alchemy many, many times. Like the winding snakes of the, yeah, you know, like that poetry there. Like Medici brought back a Jewish influence in a big way in the Renaissance. So we've covered a lot of this, that time period on the podcast, that Italian wave of alchemists, there was a Jewish influence there. And then that's also when Kabbalah rose up, that came straight out of Florence and, you know, those cities. Now, Hermeticism and Jewish influence didn't get erased throughout all of history until chemistry as a field tried purposefully to erase, you know, that past, because, you know, whatever. I mean, for good reason, no judgment here. That's just, that's, you know, people try to really look at science and say, why do we need these strange beliefs, obviously. But just keep in mind here that there's a Hermetic influence and a Hebrew influence throughout all of alchemy. And it's not always the same influence at given times. So Zosimus had both influences, which might have been very different than the same influence in Medici's time in northern Italy in the Renaissance. So just a kind of, it's a constant factor to keep in mind when discussing different periods of alchemy.
So in other words, if you look deep enough, you'll see that there the Jewish fingerprints are there as far as what they were to give to alchemy, in the sense that you will see some of that even with the evolution and change as time goes on. You're still going to be able to see some of that influence.
Yeah. It's like another way is you know, kind of the way that we've spoken about astrology here and there, where we're saying like it meant one thing here and something possibly totally different there. It just, because it just throughout the ages, the thought kept evolving and, you know, changing, and new sources came in. So, yeah, but again, to kind of bring it back to these early sources, the Leyden Papyrus had magic and alchemy itself attributed to Moses. So it also mentioned Hermes Trismegistus, but also Moses. So one of the very oldest alchemical records we have already mentions a central biblical figure, which means it obviously gave later Muslim and Christian scholars ammunition when defending alchemy. So this is neat. I mean, this is part of the reason why alchemy survived, because if it was just over the top pagan Hellenistic, it might have been shot down by the monks. But this, you know, gave its defenders some Yeah. Now, I should also say it was also fodder for some that hated alchemy, because a lot of people in the Middle Ages, especially, well, I mean, there's different periods of this, but when anti-Semitism kind of crept up, but those that hated the Jews, that also gave them fodder against alchemy. So there's a it's a double-edged sword that makes history, you know, even more complicated. Jews in this meaning would be like they would be kind of having evil sort of secret knowledge that like they were sorcerers or something. On the history of Germany, I go into like blood libel and all these things. Like they really were believed to have have supernatural powers, kind of like witchcraft, but always bad, evil stuff. And that led to pogroms and all kinds of bad stuff. So when alchemy fell out of favor, then like when the frauds and charlatans of alchemy were easily compared, they were just kind of thrown in, lumped in with anti-Semitic thought of the day. And so Jews in this scenario believed to they were taking the wisdom from Egyptian glassmaking to make precious metal lookalikes, kind of as a fraud, well as the art of making alloys of metal appear to be silver or gold. So it just instantly would flip. Like, alchemy is a negative thing because it's a Jewish thing. That's just something that happened in history. If you want to know more, that's all I'm going to say about that here, really. We want to keep going. But if you want to learn more about the anti-Semitism throughout the ages with a focus on Germany, then I did a long hour and a half episode on how and why that changed from all the way up to the Nazis' time, basically. But in this case, there was, you know, if you realize that your gold is alchemist gold, then you might start to have some anti-Semitic words, I guess, throughout history. But there's other factors that kind of give Jewish scholars of the time their gravitas in alchemy.
Well, one thing that really binds us all together, Travis, is language. And if there's a common tongue that can bind an empire together, you know, we can use that as a reference to Latin, binding the especially several different eras. You were talking about the Imperial Roman times. We're not talking about that so much. We're talking about the Holy Roman times, where Latin is the common tongue. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, the anti-Semitism is later that is attached really to the alchemy sort of backlash, came into it with the English and French and German through one particular filter, which was the Latin tongue, right? Mm-hmm. So actually everything that was older than the 12th century came from the Arabic area mostly, and with some Greek influences in the Byzantine Empire. That's where the misconception comes in, that it must be kind of linked somehow. But later, Christians in the medieval period and later after that didn't really always know this.
Right.
That was lost education when the fall of Rome comes in and we're in the Dark Ages, quote unquote. There's a lot of lost history there. And over the time, it was something to believe that the original was from the Hebrew, when in fact that they were not. And so they were really Greek, right?
Yeah.
So as it goes, added to the mysticism of alchemical texts, also making it easier to argue that they had the same authority, or at least close to it, as the Bible.
Right.
And then also because they led anti-Semites to exaggerate the Jewish influence. Add all that up together, that's kind of what the atmosphere was like at the time. All of those points were important points when discussing the influences of alchemy throughout the centuries. But it's also important to point out that all three of those, for at least 1,500 years or so, are based on false understanding of who the alchemists from the late antiquity were.
Yeah, right, yep.
Okay, so let's point out one more pitfall. By this time of alchemy, the Jews are still living in Egypt, and the Middle East had become very Hellenized. Right? They had not only translated their holy texts into Greek, but they also started writing in Greek more than the Hebrews did. So yes, some of the alchemists could have Jews, but for the most part, the texts would still be in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
We really want to point this out because there have been just all these sorts of false beliefs regarding alchemical sources, and it does get confusing depending on who you're reading or what you're trying to get from it about what the influences really were. And different false beliefs throughout history can can really perpetuate these problems, right, Trav? So, mm-hmm. you know, let's just kind of put a stopper in that if we can, to give you a better idea about what some of these influences really are. But I came across some of the wrong revisionist views and the understandings of the origins and the alchemical texts of this time. No alchemical works in Yiddish, all right? So, but yes, in Judeo-Arabic and Ladino, which is a sort of Spanish version of the Yiddish language. So there's that there too.
Mm-hmm. So again, this does not, so alchemy really doesn't go back further than Hellenistic Egypt. Only then did people start to attribute alchemical knowledge to biblical figures, and like we see with Zosimos. Zosimos writes, for instance, that Adam had four elements, four cardinal points. There's just almost like a, it's not Kabbalah, but it's almost like a sort of Kabbalah. There's like more meaning to the name, like the four elements, like the alchemical beliefs. And we have Neoplatonists, Olympiodorus, who also says that Adam was the first person to call out the four elements, or, you know, have control of the four elements. And then from them, we have many alchemists that we talked about, Latin alchemists, saying that Adam is the red earth, the philosophical mercury, Adam is sulfur, Adam is the soul, Adam is the natural fire, Eve is the counterpoint, like Eve is the white earth. So when it's mixed red and white, we see Adam and Eve, right? You get it? So Eve is of life, Eve is philosophical mercury, which Adam is too. You know, there's... You know, all, Eve is the spirit. So then we see, you know, a shift in different beliefs or what they stand for throughout time. But it keeps coming back. So, you know, Adam and Eve and the idea of them and this, and then, you know, comparing them to some chemical process that's happening. And then Adam himself being the first person to receive the alchemical knowledge. Now, this is, so in this line of thinking, there's a direct line of progression from him, from Adam, straight down to Noah, to Aaron, to Bezalel, to David, to Solomon, to Jeremiah, to Baruch, to Ezekiel, to Daniel, other prophets, ... By the 16th century, alchemy could say to go back to the beginning of man with divine origin. That's what we're talking about when we talk about these people, what alchemy meant to them, okay? Especially, yeah, I mean, throughout its history, but by the Middle Ages and after it went through that Latin filter, it is as important as the Bible. This knowledge goes way back to Adam, straight from one generation to the other, that kind of thing. We're about to do an episode on Michael Meyer. He's a chapter in the book. He's one of the people in the Renaissance and after, the early modern period, to comment on alchemical origin that goes back to Adam. And even describes this whole thing as an alchemical recipe, basically.
Well, that really kind of gives you a new spin on the idea of, you know, the making of woman from Adam's rib, right? You know, it's like you have one thing coming from Adam who can represent everything else on the alchemical chart to be making another.
Actually, yeah. Yeah. One becomes two. That's the axiom of Miriam, is like one becomes two, two becomes whatever it is.
It's four. A whole new spin on it, like, doesn't it?
Yep. There you go.
Even the Theatrum Chemicum had two chapters on this, a famous composition of the alchemical texts that we've mentioned before many times, actually on several shows. The Philosopher's Stone equals Mendus, which also equals the world in miniature, or a microcosm of a microcosm, if you will. And so basically the first chapter of Genesis is very, very important in understanding what was going on in the alchemist's mind, right? So this was thoroughly entrenched by the golden age of alchemy, and to ignore this would be a huge mistake.
Yeah.
Paracelsus also believed that Adam received divine alchemical wisdom, and also that this of the elixir of life. All right, boy, really adding into all the stuff we know from every show, isn't it, that we've done so far? And again, a reminder that Miriam the Jewish was also at this time definitely thought of to be the sister of Moses himself. Right.
Yeah.
In Psalms 118:22, Solomon disallows the philosopher's stone. The stone with which the builders rejected is become the chief cornerstone.
Yeah, that's how that was interpreted as like, oh, Solomon is, you know, disallowing the, yeah, like he's banning alchemy.
Yeah, a line in the sand. The longevity of the antediluvian biblical characters are because of the stone itself, right? So we brought it upon ourselves, I guess, to have this great flood. So one of the characters that we talked about on our show is Elias Ashmole. And he mentioned that Solomon, Moses, Hermes Trismegistus were the only adepts that we were talking about with this. So another word for this is the tetragrammaton, which is the word of God.
So we mentioned that Adam had the power. So Seth, Adam's third son, is the adept who taught, according to Agatha Damon, who we did an episode on. Remember the father of poison, maybe? I don't remember. But Tubal Cain in Genesis 4:22, the Bible says, forger of every cutting instrument of brass and iron. So, I mean, he was like a smith, a blacksmith or something. And alchemists grabbed onto that.
So the Book of Enoch, the one where the angels come down and have the kids with the women, of course, right? You remember that story?
Yeah.
didn't just have kids, but they also gave them charms and enchantments, taught them about cutting of roots and plants. Azazel taught men knowledge of the metals of the earth and the art of working them, and bracelets and ornaments, and the use of precious stones and all the coloring tinctures. Now, also uses astrology in this story as well, and also how to read the clouds and other divinations. In fact, mm-hmm. It's from Zosimos' description as these angels teach mankind metalworking, where he uses the word chema, right, which is another word for alchemy.
Yeah, exactly. So it's actually this. So chema is what became alchemy. That word, that's how we get the word alchemy. This was actually a description of a biblical text when, you know, it's a commentary on the Book of Enoch. So, yeah, I mean, so alchemy is central to this biblical stuff.
Ham, who's the son of Noah, the notion existed that it was named after Ham, who was the first practitioner. He was specifically the Hellenistic Jewish origin, right? Mezarim's son is Atotis, also known as Hermes or Mercurius, who became the king of Thebes. Alchemy could have also started with the wife of Noah or Sibylla or Nimrod's wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which now that brings us to Abraham and Sarah, because they were also alchemists, obviously. Hold on.
Wait a minute.
Genesis 13:12 states that Abraham was rich in cattle, silver, and gold. Abraham was also not immune to the suspicions of alchemists that he was himself an alchemist, okay? According to this line of thought, he learned alchemy in Egypt from Hermes himself. Now, some that disagree with the whole Alexander the Great legend of the Emerald Tablet saying that Sarah took the hands of the dead Hermes in a cave of Hebron. So that's this there's this really famous Hermetic legend that involves Alexander the Great. Some say that this Sarah was like the biblical Sarah of Abraham, and tying Sarah to the whole Hermetic, you know, Emerald Tablet and just to the most central core of Hermeticism, which is the Emerald Tablet and the as above, so below and all that stuff. So Abraham and Sarah were not immune to being suspected of being alchemists.
So in Genesis 20:10-22, it tells us of Jacob's dream with the ladder to heaven, Jacob's ladder. We're all pretty familiar with that story, yeah. I believe. It also mentions that he had this dream in Bethel while sleeping on a stone. Upon waking, Jacob anointed the stone and concluded a pact with God.
Must be an alchemist.
There you go.
Well,
that's an alchemist star.
But business. Seriously, yeah. In the Middle Ages, that like that's if you say the word stone in the Bible, they're like, that must be that's why he had that dream. You know, he used a stone right. as a pillow. So yep.
So one can find an alchemical art and illustrations of a young man sleeping with a stone for a pillow. Sometimes even with Jacob's ladder sort of mentioned in the background. Yeah. So you'll see that in a lot of these.
And I always wonder. So the more I learned about this, the more a lot of those alchemical images kind of came into focus. I was like, oh, okay. So, yeah, this comes from this biblical passage that, you know, Jacob's, I have seen Jacob's ladder and wondered, like, what does that have to do with anything? So, he's napping on the philosopher's stone. Yep.
So these biblical beliefs within alchemy were held right up until alchemy's end of the 18th century. We're talking a long time that people were holding on to this, right? So that's really important to note that in this podcast tonight, that this is something that just stayed with humanity for quite some time.
Yeah, Genesis, if you read Genesis 36, verse 39, to an alchemist's eyes, other kings may have known the secret. First Chronicles 1:50, the wife of Hadar, king of Edom, was, quote, Mehetabel, daughter of Matred, daughter of Mezahan. Now, Mezahan, and there's a line above the E, so I don't know how to, I probably butchered that, sorry. But that means water of gold. That's like, potable water. Yeah. So there's, that's, for an alchemist, that was like when they figured out what that meant. Yeah. So like gold and water, this is, obviously it could be referring to water with gold dust in it, or even just the idea of golden water. But alchemists took to mean this is potable gold, like the elixir of life, like the philosopher's stone. And there's a theory mentioned by Patai, that's the author of the Jewish Alchemist, and he says that when it was translated to greed, like Mizahav became metabol, like transmutation. So it really took on this alchemical meaning. But okay, I already mentioned the example of Methuselah, who lived to be 969 years. Well, obviously, you know, alchemists thought that must be because of the elixir of life. He just, you know, he had the secret. And now that you're in the right mindset, okay, to see what the alchemists were seeing when reading the Bible, let's take a look at Job.
Here's another example of this in Job 22, verse 22 through 25. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. If you remove wickedness far from your tent and assign your nuggets to the dust, your gold of Ophir to the rocks in this ravines, then the Almighty will be your gold, the choicest silver for you. So just by reading that, Travis, you're just talking about all these precious minerals that we're talking that are chief of alchemical thought, right? So you can also imagine that these are seen as a recipe right then and there, almost right down to a T.
Yeah.
But certainly Job had the alchemical within his grasp, and if he returned it to the Almighty, then that would seal the deal. So Job's daughters were Jemima, Keza, and Kiran Hapuk, where Keza equals still. Kiran Hapuk means equals the retort with an inverted sort of horn, which is also a puk stone. Also known as a horn for strength, and of the stone itself, which is the science of alchemy. So I think you have a lot of people here taking these stories and then saying, how can we equate this?
Like really alchemy? Reading into it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of reading between the lines here. But this takes us, Travis, to really the guy on top of the mountain, man, Moses.
Yeah. So Moses was in the history of alchemy from day one. Okay. And that's even, and he was mentioned as late as the 19th century in context of alchemy. I mean, so Moses was always a part of the history of alchemy, in the Western world, always Arabic and Greek and, you know, Egyptian tradition. Moses was always, so from Zosimos on, Moses was always central. Hermes Trismegistus was like, you know, contemporary of Moses. Always central. Now, Moses was sometimes even considered to be the co-founder along with Hermes, and alchemy can even be referred to as mosaico-hermetic art. That's what it was referred to as. They're talking about alchemy, saying this mosaico-hermetic art. To make matters a bit murkier is that there was this pseudo-Moses in Hellenistic Egypt running around writing alchemical texts. So even from earliest times, alchemists were already being confused on whether they were quoting the biblical lawgiver or this pseudo-Moses alchemist. Okay.
You can see the confusion. All right. So Zosimus knew this was a different Moses. For instance, from recent times, in his times, of course, but elsewhere, speaks as if the Moses of great antiquity was the biblical Moses, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the domestic chemistry of Moses is in the Leyden Papyrus. this we mentioned this before early in the podcast tonight. This ties many alchemical recipes to Exodus 31:1-5 and 30 through 35 verses there, so to make it seem like it was the biblical Moses writing that.
Mm-hmm.
He's even called Moses the thrice happy.
Yeah, like thrice Hermes Trismegistus, so thrice happy instead of thrice great. Yeah.
Diplosis of Moses, or doubling of the weight of gold, in page 32 of the Jewish Alchemists, has this particular recipe, of course. Mm-hmm. And Moses was even thought to maybe be just as different name for Hermes himself, Hermes Trismegistus, right? Yeah. So people are throwing this and getting a little bit confused, as we are reading this. Another late theory has Hermes Trismegistus, Mercurius, as a disciple of Moses himself. He was instructed uncommonly well in the doctrine of Genesis transmitted by Moses. And that's in page 34 of this text. Look at this part. The golden calf is a part of the alchemical interpretation, right? It says it right there, basically. We talk about the worshiping of the golden calf. In Exodus, when Moses came back and found them worshiping this golden calf, he took the calf which they had made and burnt it with fire and ground it into powder and strewed it among them in the water, and then made the children of Israel drink it. And that's in Exodus 32, verse 20, an aureum portable.
Yeah. Potable gold, basically. Yeah.
Okay.
Right there.
It's potable gold.
Yep. It's right there. Potable gold, Exodus 32, verse 20. There it is. They ground up gold, put it in the water, and drank it. Okay? There it is. Right there in the Bible.
Can't so, do that for you.
Yeah.
but done. And Travis, don't we have something like that in what we've talked about? Would people try to do that in the Middle Ages of drinking gold to heal?
Gold was actually not – this is actually something that's weirdly almost universal. It's like even Chinese alchemy had this, but where just gold was thought to have healing properties, even just by, you know, drinking gold dust. So, yeah, it was just seen as a really good thing.
So Moses did end up with a lot of gold for his tabernacle, right? And at this point, this was not lost on medieval alchemists. It was something they kept bringing back and forth, right? Jabir ibn Hayyan, also known as Geber, has Moses as the founder of alchemy. And Hayyan is maybe the first in the strict tradition of the belief that he was the founder. Along with Zosimos, Democritus, Hermes, and Agathodaimon, etc. Go back and forth through the list of all the people we talked about on this show.
Yeah, each one of those has their own episode. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, very common topic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Korah, or Korim, stole from him this secret of alchemy.
Other Arab alchemists tried to do the same. Like, we've done a show on Pseudo-Madriti, for instance.
Remember, already many in Egypt were either defending the old ways or the Christian ways or the monotheistic ways or ways that they all sort of jive together. Some say that Moses was taught not just by the Egyptians, but also by the Greeks, I guess in a way to hurt the Greeks' feelings or something of that nature,
yeah.
Right? But you also know that Moses had also had a reputation as a magician. I mean, think of him carrying that big staff, right? You know, and coming up with these great sort of deals. The idea spread very quickly through the Roman Empire, for instance, and it kind of latched onto that idea of a powerful magician. In the 17th century, Moses, as an alchemist, was entrenched within alchemist circles. From this century, we see that most people were arguing against this, though. Both alchemists were trying to separate the Hermeticism from the Bible, and also that they were also against alchemy altogether because of the reasons we mentioned in this podcast early in the episode. So, things are trying to be pulled apart, maybe to give it more credence to a science or try to blame it more
exactly
on the idea of being Jewish. You know,
yeah,
that they didn't separate.
Yeah, separate the facts. Like these minerals handle this way, and these acids separate those facts from the, you know, we get this knowledge from Moses. Because that's, you know, that's just, yeah. That's giving the whole thing about reputation. So then there was a concerted effort to stop that. But, okay, so I'll mention, now we'll probably revisit Miriam the Jewess at some point. Because I have a bunch more information on her and I'm working my way through it. But I will mention the confusion or, you know, Moses' sister, Miriam. And this is because often, just like Zosimos seems to know that there was a pseudo Moses right before his time, he sometimes also called or pretended like he was the Moses from the Bible. And very much like that, perhaps before Zosimos, but shortly, just shortly before his time or during his time, there was Miriam the Jewess. And we'll get a lot more, we'll come back to her, but in other episodes. We did do a whole episode on her before, so if you wanted to learn more. But in this case, she was also associated with Moses. And a fella in the 4th century, Epiphanus, even describes visions of Christ to her. So he writes about her in Great Questions and Small Questions. He speaks of her telling of her visions to Jesus, and it's not exactly sure where this quote comes from. But it's interesting to note that even if this was not a real quote from Miriam, which, it's doubted that it is, it still speaks of Christian legends about her a century after Zosimos, which is kind of neat. And from there, sources and legends push her back further into antiquity, again, to where Miriam the Jewess becomes Miriam of the Bible. And we see her later mentioned in Arabic sources as Miriam the Copt, like someone that's Coptic, and Matron Maria Sicula. And in those legends, she's a contemporary of Jesus now, and also knew him. And we see, we've done an episode on Austenes. There's Arabic sources that say she studied under Austenes. We'll see it. I mean, you'll see it in our episode there that Austenes and Jesus lived separate, centuries apart. So, it just kind of gets murky in some of these legends. But it has her as a master alchemist. This legend definitely lived on. And by the time the sources made its way to the later Latin writings, Miriam had gone to being a contemporary of Moses himself, for sure.
I find it very interesting that we have a woman that's given so much credibility in a time that was a very sort of masculine sort of field, and that she's got a place in history all throughout these historical references. So I find that kind of amazing in itself.
Mm-hmm. There's Michael Meyer. He's one of the people in our upcoming book that was in Prague. He kind of debated, let's say, whether Miriam was fictitious or Moses' sister or just a Jewish alchemist. And he comes to the conclusion in the 17th century that she's real because of the rich tradition around her, but it isn't quite sure about her being Moses' sister. And I would say modern scholars would say, yeah, she was an alchemist in the first century. That's what we said on her show. That's our best guess. Michael Meyer finally says it's possible since she could be a prophet. She may have learned chemistry from Moses. So he leaves the options open. So, really, even in his times, and he's really debating this, he still says it's possible that she's biblical. So, she becomes famous again from Meyer's publication, and out of Meyer's lists a great 12 alchemists, and Miriam is the only one of those 12. So, clearly a central figure in the history of alchemy.
Now, if we jump over to Korah, and Korah rebelled against Moses, and he is and his men were swallowed up, and this is in Numbers 16. In the Midrash, Korah and Haman are said to have been the richest men on earth. Now, Korah became rich by finding one of Joseph's treasures hidden in Egypt. He died because his riches were not the gift of heaven, and that his revolt against Moses was encouraged by his wife. All right, that's the story,
that's how it goes. Rightfully,
yeah, being a bad influence, right? The Quran, 28, verse 76 through 82, Korah is thought to have been given these riches because which were the knowledge was within him. Arabic commentators who also knew the Midrash and the Bible has Quran as an adept of the alchemy who learned from his wife. History of Alchemy episode on the Quran's wife, probably not, but maybe so. Anyway, he learned all this from Moses. The Arab legend tells that Moses and Aaron were given the gift of alchemy directly from God in order to cover the Ark of the Covenant in gold. They outsourced to Korah, who in one Arabic source had him as a goldsmith. had built himself riches and palaces of walls of precious metals, yeah. and in the end smote it by God.
Yeah, so he paid for his sins, I guess, of greed. But yeah, so all of this was just brought back to, yeah. So even the Ark of the Covenant was covered in alchemist gold. There you go.
So next time you watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know something better now.
That's right. Nazis die by removing it. So anyways, they all face melt. Now, the Israelite judge Gideon, he gathered dew with fleece of wool. This might tie this to like the Greek golden fleece kind of things. But alchemists tied this judge to the legend of, you know, Jason, the golden fleece.
Sure.
By the 16th century, by Guillermus Menes breaks down both legends and ties them together. So we really see this stretch of imagination almost to tie this Israelite judge to Jason, you know, which is, I mean, they're centuries apart, these stories. But you can see images of Jason's legend in alchemy, so it's important to recognize the Gideon version, too, that Gideon's fleece might have been meant instead of Jason's fleece, if you see a depiction of it. And then, of course, another great figure, a couple figures here in order, are King Dave. David was rich. For the temple, he saved up, quote, 100,000 talents of gold and 1,000,000 talents of silver. The dude was a talented millionaire. Do you see what I...
I see what you did there, and I don't like it.
You're like, and I'm So he was very talented. That meant he had many talents. Anyways, so Alchemist would read this, and obviously he got his riches through the Philosopher's Stone. So 2 Chronicles 29:2, verse 2, includes the Stone of Phuch. And in his inheritance list to Solomon, so along with the gold and silver, he's got this, well, it looks like a philosopher's stone, okay, to make more. That's because those philosopher's stones, he was able to make silver and gold to be in Jerusalem as stones. That's where they get that from. So 2 Chronicles 1:15 and then also 1 Kings 10:27 says gold and silver was so common that it in Jerusalem, just the common stones were gold and silver. But if an alchemist reads that same passage, they're like, oh, this is saying they're using the Philosopher's Stone to make gold and silver. It's a misinterpretation, clearly, but that's clear proof if you're an alchemist.
I see. I think people want to read what they want to read.
Exactly. They just read. Yeah, exactly. They're like, you know, just like their eyes must have lit up and be like, oh, it mentions stones in the Bible. And in the same sentence as gold and silver. Done. So,
and really one of the big names in the Old Testament, we're talking about, you know, King Solomon, and Solomon's wisdom here is reinterpreted as including knowledge of alchemy. Now, alchemists quoted Solomon, not in the Bible though, but needless to say, they quoted him as saying, neither did I liken her with wisdom to any precious gem, but because of all the gold on earth in her sight is but a little sand, and silver shall be accounted as clay before her. Now, with that, they interpreted directly as referring to the knowledge of the philosopher's stone. Right? So this really comes down to this, and Zosimos attributes his writing on this production and uses the quicksilver or mercury in this way as like not just mercury, but metallic arsenic contained the key to the great art, quote unquote. So later in the 8th century, a treatise on how to make silver was attributed to Solomon. This work is from the Temple of Helos, which calls for the Eastern and Western quicksilver and the usual 40 days.
Yeah.
Now the Song of Songs of Solomon, a very famous part of the Bible, is an alchemical treatise as well, right there in the Bible. You can see it right there today. In Arabic folklore, though, Solomon gets the additional stories of Nabi Sulaiman, where Solomon is the master of demons. Also, the Jewish folklore, this is what this story also lives there. And also the master of alchemy and metallurgy. The Stone Book of Aristotle has Solomon commanding ants to dig him up some red sulfur, or gold, if you will. And he also invented the iron plows, weapons, and utensils. In Arabian Nights, Solomon uses the miraculous lead seal to lock evil spirits into the bottles, also hinting at him being an alchemist. Michael Meyer, even Johann Joachim Becker, asserted Solomon as an authority on alchemy. And according to these gentlemen, he actually had this stone himself. Queen of Sheba first inherited her stone from Solomon. All right? All this is coming together for you folks because it's coming together for me. Seeing how this read what you want to read, right? Syriac writer who quotes Zosimos also said, talismans of Solomon, like flasks, seven talismans, same as like the storing demons, or in reference to it. All right, here's the list we have. These talismans act like prayers against demons, made of electrum. Angels ordered Solomon to make these flasks. Making the flask as far from the angels is clearly as alchemical recipe with sulfur and metals, and then inscribed with a formula, burnt gold, Sion, or silver, called of the ant, whitened copper, tender and softened iron, lead, purified silver, which is loon. In fact, take a close look at the Star of David. In the flag of Israel, for example, you'll see this. Are you sure that that's not exactly the symbols for fire, water overlaid? Or is it?
Oh, what? What have we here? Israel is an alchemical state. Yeah. It's an alchemical state.
Yeah, it's the alchemical symbol for wisdom and also fiery water.
So Hebrew for heaven is Shamayim. So Esh for fire and Mayim for water. So even there you go. There's fiery water. That was often noted by alchemists. So like the Star of David can actually represent quintessence or the universal matter, the fifth element, that whole ordeal.
And in the 17th century, people opposed to alchemy had to actually argue that Solomon could have gotten his riches in the usual way through mining. If you can believe that,
it sounds so exciting. They actually had to argue. They're like, no, it doesn't have to be through alchemy. He could have gotten it other ways. But whether it was
fine.
Yeah, they still didn't, you know, there was no doubt that the tale of Solomon was real. Just, you know, they had to give it a non-alchemical interpretation,
sure, which is interesting. Was key here. And so this brings us to Elijah. All right. Paracelsus echoes a common belief among alchemists that Elijah knows all and will reveal all in the end of days. And this comes from the Jewish influence. Elijah was often even in the title of the works by alchemists.
Mm-hmm. Isaiah also, again, like Elijah and other prophets, Isaiah was thought to be an alchemist. Isaiah 54 verse 11 says, behold, I will set the stones in fair colors and lay thy foundations with sapphires, and I will make thy pinnacles of rubies and thy gates of carbuncles and all thy borders of precious stones. And so plural stones, red and white philosopher's stones is how that's interpreted. Sapphire is like the last stage of alchemy, this iosis or oxidation. And chapter 60, verse 17 says, for brass I will bring gold, and for iron I will bring silver. Sounds like transmutation to me. Yeah, Daniel is interpreted as an alchemist. Ezra, there's a Syriac collection, the Book of Ezra, the sage scribe, which just has it contains names of plants and planets and metals, and it also has an alchemical treatise. So we see Ezra as a biblical figure. There's more. We can keep going. I think we all get the point here. This show's looking to be almost an hour long. Now, so I think this is, you definitely, if you've never read the Bible before, then you might understand why they thought so much of this influence, you know, this alchemical stuff came from the Bible. And just given the authority of the Bible, it's just so hard to understate that there were no non-believers, maybe secretly, maybe behind closed doors. But officially, the Bible was taken as fact. It was taken as the oldest written record of mankind. It was, you know, what the priests said was often law. So it's just a really important thing. And to ignore it would be folly. If you're looking at the history of alchemy, you got to know your Old Testament. Simple. But I think we've shown that here tonight.
That's a good point.
And your Quran. You need to know your Quran.
Yeah.
What?
Well, you know, knowing all three, the aspect of Christianity, Judaism, and Islamic belief, to have a little bit of knowledge about that is going to help you walk through about what many people thought in later times, how to either keep the alchemical knowledge going, you know, that you could actually still do it without being persecuted as a wizard or a witch.
You had
to have this backing.
Yeah, you don't have to watch TV. You don't have to listen to the radio. I don't care. But if you don't get my pop culture reference, then don't come crying to me, okay? You can, very much like that, you can read alchemy, but if you don't get that biblical reference, hey, you got to know this piece of the puzzle. You got to know how this was interpreted. So, that just took me forever to kind of run down and prepare. I had this idea for a long time, and I finally got my hands on The Jewish Alchemist, which helped a lot with that, so... There's going to be more to come from that book, but there's also I want to research a bunch of other sources for the early Arabic time period and some other time periods. So
I still probably wouldn't go to your rabbi or to your priest or preacher and just say, hey, did you know that Moses was an alchemist? I probably wouldn't do that, but just know that at some point in history, someone said that.
Yeah, at some point in history, you could have a good argument if you believed that. So, other than that, we just wrapped up our yearly review. We've been on the air for four years now. Can you believe that?
Nope.
it's
gone by quick.
Yeah, we're doing great. So we recommend to listen to that. We'll give you kind of a state of the podcast, if you will. And year four, we got plenty more to come. So don't worry about it. We're not dead, even if we just show up like twice a year. I mean, downloads are coming, so hey. But if you want to kick us, get us to do more, then follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook at Alchemy Podcast or Alchemy Podcast News on Facebook. There's even a group where you can post your own things, and often those things people post become ideas for shows. That being said, we have hundreds of ideas already written down in our lists. But all of that, we've been super busy, so we're not going to repeat everything here, but we do about 7 podcasts now. What? Yeah, that's right. So for all of those,
it's not a full-time job either.
So for all of those, go to podcastnik.com. That's podcastnik.com. Podcastnik.com. There you go. And go have a listen, see what else we've been up to. Secret Cabinet, Africa, A History, History of Germany, Bohemian Podcast. And even more. So,
but Travis, what if I want a t-shirt with a homunculus on it? Where do I go?
Oh, there is a shop, in fact, same link, but yeah, so we have a graphic designer now that has been cranking out, designs for our shirts and stickers, and there's homunculus stickers, which I don't know if they're actually for sale yet. Those might be part of the care package for super fans. And there's a hidden way to get those, but I'm not going to tell you. But yeah, we got a PayPal link up. People actually asked us for PayPal and Patreon and stuff, so we have that up on the. You can support us there. You can buy the Alchemy booklet. You can buy our new Alchemy Show book when it comes out. You can buy Curious Czech Christmas from the Bohemian Podcast by myself and Pete. And I would definitely recommend checking out the homunculus t-shirt. That's pretty cool. I'm really happy with the designs that have been coming out.
It really looks cool. It's nice.
Yep, there's a History of Germany t-shirt now for the first time that features he's a vandal, I believe.
But he's a sophisticated vandal. Well, he's having a spot of tea.
He's hella sophisticated. so Emperor Norton shirt's coming out later. But yeah, anyways, all of that's in the other podcast. I don't want to repeat that all here. Bottom line is you guys have been great. We've seen a lot of reviews on iTunes, which help us the very most in getting new members. People have been linking to the show from their blogs and other websites, and that has brought in a lot of new listeners. So first of all, welcome. Second of all, there's a lot of other stuff going on. But yeah, we really appreciate all the support in the last year. And above all, just thank you very much for listening.
Take care.
I'm going to be very careful with how I pronounce that.
Say four. Like
it's
that,
the stones of f***.
Oh, God.
That's what it... PH.
I know.
Okay.
Don't.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.